You are listening to From the Margins on CHSR 97.9.
Aggressive state intervention into the local labor movement that ensures that the radical labor movements are marginal.
What they're looking for now is less to get elected and more to come to the favorable attention of capital.
For the first time in history, we have a movement in this country led by indigenous peoples and most importantly, indigenous women.
Repeatedly we've seen the attempt to criminalize black victims, to do anything to smear their names, to basically imply that black life isn't worth anything.
Our society teaches women to be ashamed of their bodies, to hate their bodies, to change their bodies.
We see increasing organized repression.
I'm stubborn. I'm not going to back down. This could go on for years and years and years.
People need to realize what side of the struggle that they're on.
The police, of course, want you to believe that there's some kind of criminal reason behind this.
Take every day as an act of resistance, whether it was a strike, a riot, or whatever.
It's very difficult for people to engage in sustained dissent. I don't believe it's impossible, though.
And hello, we are live now. We got a full studio today. Cody, hello.
Hello.
And we got MC Lids here. How are you doing?
Doing well.
All right, so we got lots of good stuff on today. So on the menu today, we have the issue of unpaid interns, an interview coming up with Andrew Mead, freelance media worker who's a member of the Canadian Workers of America. I'm going to be getting into that issue, some critical aspects of that issue and so on. And then the next thing up is going to be the subject of organizing panhandlers and other street workers, an interview with Andrew Nellis, an organizer with the Street Laborers of Windsor and formerly with the Ottawa Panhandlers Union. He has a lot of interesting stories and critical analysis, etc. Somebody who is as good as anybody in the entire country for talking about that subject. And then finally, for the grand finale, we got some killer rhymes coming up. Okay, so that's what we have up. Cody, over to you.
Hey, so just to give some context as to kind of where we are in Canada when it comes to internships and unpaid internships, just last week, according to a story out of the Star, published February 9th, the Canadian Labour Code just recently put in aspects on the internship program where they fall underneath basic formats for health and safety, but there's going to be changes to that where they'll be under the safety of the legislation, but still unpaid, and you can have unpaid internships, and the in air quotes I put here, where it is primarily to the benefit of the intern. So this is problematic in that it's very vague into what that means. Whereas if you compare it to Ontario, which recently just changed their internship laws to be that internships can only exist where it is tied directly to academic credit. So You can have an internship, but it has to be tied directly to an academic industry where the university will regulate and make sure that the rules are being applied. Now, switch to New Brunswick. Earlier this week, I emailed the Ministry of Postsecondary Education and Labor and got an email back from a communications officer named Megan Wallace. And so I asked her two and a half questions, one being, do interns fall underneath the Employment Standard Act within New Brunswick? The answer was no. There is no provisions for interns or internships. And then I also asked, are there any legislation in New Brunswick that covers interns at all? And she said, there is not any legislation under the minister's responsibility that covers interns or internships. So, I mean, it leaves it vague as though there might be another ministry that could have it, but considering the ministry's post-secondary education and labor, if it doesn't fall underneath that ministry, I don't know what ministry it would fall under. And just kind of, there is a position by the New Brunswick Students Alliance, which is the alliance that represents a majority of the Anglophone institutions and students here in the province, and they have a position where they would like to see the provincial government put interns under the Employment Standards Act, and that they be treated as employees and should be entitled to remuneration equivalent to, or at minimum, to minimum wage. So that's kind of where we're at in New Brunswick. There really is no protections under the provincial legislation.
Wow, just another category where New Brunswick is last as far as rights in any particular area goes. Okay, so with that intro, did you have any more to add, Cody, or are we ready to go to the piece?
Unless you wanted to touch on the Irving situation, I do not.
Maybe I might leave that for another time.
Okay.
It's more or less along the lines of what you were saying, Cody.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you have an employer that is able to benefit off of free labor, off of people because of their classification. They're not classified as workers per se, but classified as students who are fulfilling the requirements of their program. Like right before they graduate, they need to do a term of an internship where they're supposedly just training. So that's the real gray area, but it really gets into what you were saying already. So
yeah, I guess there is one thing I just remembered where the issue that was brought up by the Canadian Interns Association, which is another large group that represents people, is that this would basically, the legislation for federal responsibility, which is banking and telecommunications, would basically turn internships into another form of unpaid probation. So not only would you have a four-month unpaid probation, you would have like 6 months of paid probation. So it basically would put your probationary period to almost a year, which is pretty precarious.
Indeed. All right, so let's go to the interview now with Andrew Mead. So there's another intro at the beginning of this piece as well. So this is Andrew Mead with the Communication Workers of America on unpaid internships.
Hi, I'm Andrew Mead. I am a freelance photographer in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I am also a sitting member of the Fredericton District Labor Council, Communication Workers of America Canada Associate Members Program, a steering committee, and a member of the Canadian Freelance Union.
First off, before we get into subjects about what unpaid interns are going through, what is an unpaid intern?
Unpaid interns are usually students, but can be any worker that is hired on a contract or without a contract to learn the trades or the way workplaces operate and the skills that they need to go off afterwards and complete paid work.
So you're, as you mentioned, a member of a union, particularly media workers. So within that industry, within media, how common are unpaid internships?
Unpaid internships are very common in the media world. Journalism schools require a number of hours worked in a unpaid internship for credit, which lends itself to being often exploited by companies and employers that see this influx every year of interns coming out and needing placements. And some are good, some are more exploitative.
Thinking about these unpaid interns in various industries, and you're, of course, most familiar with the media, as I understand it, they'll be working beside others who are actually getting paid. So how do you distinguish the unpaid interns from those who are considered to actually be workers?
You're correct. Unpaid interns, or interns in general, do similar work. Technically, the unpaid interns should be receiving training to have a benefit to the intern, not to the company. You're not hired as an employee. You're brought on as an intern to learn the skills that you need to do the job and presumably get paid when you're finished and move off into the workforce, not to replace the work of paid labor and full-time staffers or contracts. So there should be a mentor or someone that you're shadowing or is looking out and helping you build your portfolio, build your skills, and further your education, not do the same work as paid staff as a replacement. Say, staff go away for vacation, and then the intern is stuck doing the same job for no pay.
So this is an example of what you were mentioning earlier about how these programs can be abused or exploited by employers.
Yes, yes. Not to say that it always happens, but it can happen, and particularly in the media world, as I'm familiar with, where young workers are trying to get their foot in the door and will do whatever they're asked and often do not know their rights or want to push for them because it's less advantageous to them to argue and ask questions instead of just doing what their employers want.
Recently, there was some news about the Canadian Association of Interns has been concerned about legislation coming down the pipe that will allow the extension or expansion of unpaid internships. Could you comment on what's going on?
In the 2015 Budget Implementation Act put out by the Conservative government of last year, they had passed laws further allowing unpaid interns into federally regulated workplaces for periods of up to 4 months in full-time positions or up to a year in part-time. And these rules also allow 1 year of part-time work to be repeated if the intern had not fulfilled 3 months of full-time work in federally regulated workplaces. This was proposed by the current government and the Canadian Association of Interns. They've been sitting at the table with the Minister of Environment, Workforce Development and Labour, Marianne Mosheuk, to try and resolve this and come to a ground that will be pleasing to both parties, but that has kind of ground to a halt, and they're urging the minister to make changes to this.
Yeah, as I understood, the Canadian Association of Interns walked away because they're unhappy.
They left the table because they were not going anywhere, and they've been on this since the proposal went through in December of last year.
So what are your union affiliations saying about what's happening now with unpaid interns?
We at the CWA Canada, the Associate Members Program, we've just went through drafting some model language to present to member locals to include in their collective agreements about unpaid interns. And we did a fairly exhaustive review of collective agreements of member locals across the country and found out whose contracts had clauses regarding interns, and some did, some didn't.
What are some key things that you want to see as far as language and contracts go?
In our the document we put together and drafted on model language for internships, we want interns to have equity and exclusivity. Historically, marginalized communities are being shed out of media work due to their inability to engage in unpaid labor, which is unfortunately a big part of media these days. So paid internships would attract people from marginalized groups and groups that are unable to provide free labor and live, which would diversify and improve media coverage and the diversity of the workforce. And also, we want to look out for the safety of interns. Unpaid interns who must take paid work on top of internships are susceptible to overwork. I believe if you go back a year or two, there was a student working in a radio room out west and was just working, and
Andy Ferguson was a 22-year-old student in the radio and TV program at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology in Edmonton. He was in the midst of an unpaid internship while also doing a paid internship. On November the 1st, 2011, Andy's car collided with a cement truck. He was killed. He was driving home after an overnight shift at Astral Radio. So what are some key protections you're looking for?
One of the big things that we were looking for was that the interns are being brought into the workplace as part of a training initiative. It's in collaboration with post-secondary institutions, and we don't want the interns to come in and be used as cheap replacement labor for holidays or sick leave or any loss of staff. So we want to make sure that that is brought in so that the employers know that they can't bring unpaid work in to replace paid work. Also, we're looking to make sure that interns are covered by the hours of work and scheduling and overtime provisions of their fellow workers' collective agreements. So their schedule, their days of work, their days off, and overtime and everything is structured the same way that it would be if they were full-time or contract employees, not just being used willy-nilly to go here, go there at a moment's notice, so that they have same rights and responsibilities as their fellow workers.
So you've done one or two unpaid internships before? How many have you done before?
I've done two unpaid internships. I did them last spring in Ottawa after finishing a photojournalism program at Loyalist College in Ontario.
You went in to your unpaid internships with certain expectations. What ended up happening?
I expected to go in and be able to do the work. I've worked in newsrooms before, so it wasn't a new environment, a new experience for me. But I had expected to go in and be allowed to do the work, but I would have consultations or critiques with staff and editors more regularly to further my learning instead of just showing up, being given assignments, and sent out to the job while other staff did theirs. It was effectively the same job as paid staff.
Yeah, did you feel that in that process that you were at various times taken advantage of?
I don't think I was taken advantage of. No one was going out of their way to exploit me, but I think that when I was working as an intern and my work was getting the same play and the same recognition across the chain, across the province and country, and the same front pages as the staffers, I'm a big believer that if my work is of quality to run on the front page or next to the staffers who have been working there for many more years, I should at least get compensation. I'm a big proponent of the equal work for equal pay.
You mentioned about set hours and about how it's important for interns to know what the parameters are of what they're doing. In your own experience, did you find that you had an expectation of a schedule, but you ended up getting called in when you weren't expecting it?
Yes. That is also the nature of the beast in daily news media. The news cycle is always going and something's always happening, and that can be expected in the field, but some days I would work 9 to 5 regularly. Some days it would be 10 to 2. Some days I'd work late, depending on what I was covering. Some days I wouldn't be told until that day when I came in that, oh, you need to work late. And if I was getting paid for that, that's not a problem. It's a bit of a headache if you show up to your workplace and you need to work 2 hours longer, but then if you're working, you can claim overtime. But when you're asked to work extra time and not getting paid for it, but you very well can't or feel like you can't refuse, I feel like that's a bit of a burden on the interns.
All right, so we're talking a lot about media, and media is its own beast, but there's also large industries, big companies that are using unpaid interns. There's a recent story about Irving using unpaid interns. What are your thoughts on these larger entities using unpaid interns?
I think that unpaid internships can be used and are helpful when stuck in the parameters of being used for educational benefit. So they're set and students will work the X amount of hours or X weeks for course credit. I believe that is the only way that unpaid internships should exist in the work world. If it's not for the student's benefit and it benefits the employer more than the student, what is the difference between an intern and a contract job that you're getting paid for? I think that even students working, if they're doing work and learning but still providing benefit to the company, they should get paid. If you're doing work, you should be paid.
So, Andrew, you're going to be going to what's called a Halifax Media Mixer pretty soon, which is going to involve the Dalhousie Gazette, Halifax Media Co-op, Halifax Typographical Union, King Student Union, News Photographers Association of Canada, Professional Writers Association of Canada, Travel Media Association of Canada. So that's a lot of different media organizations. What is expected to happen at this event?
This event is going to be a mixer of various media workers around Halifax, Nova Scotia, Atlantic Canada. We're having discussions and panel mentorship in regards to training, mentorship, talking about issues in the field. Internships coming up. It's coming into the end of the middle of the school year for journalism schools. Just a evening to get out and network and ask questions and learn, connect with fellow workers and see what their problems are and the struggles and how we can work together and learn and continue doing what we do.
Do you expect that the subject of unpaid internships, maybe critiques of the program, may arise at this event?
I have no doubt that there will be a lot of discussion about that. Like I said, most journalism schools require an unpaid internship portion of their classes. And we have some workshops going on at that event on how to build sustainable careers in the media, as well as critiques and mentorships and opportunities to talk with working professionals in print, photography, TV, broadcast, online media, and make connections and bridge the gap from being an unpaid intern and a student or a precarious media worker to having a more stable footing in the industry.
Is there any kind of a know your rights as an intern kind of a workshop or anything like that?
We do discuss that a fair bit. It's a very hot topic and something that is very important, and most schools glance over but do not give as great a emphasis to the students. So I don't believe we're having anything expressly about that at this event, but there are events in the future that will address that.
All right, so we just heard that interview with Andrew. Any thoughts, Cody? Do you have any thoughts on some of the things that we heard?
Well, it kind of reminds me it's a part of our culture so much now that there's I'm not sure if you're familiar, there's like an internet comedy group called College Humor, and they did a thing where it's like the truth about internships, and so they go into it kind of thing. And this idea, they posted a study in the United States that although people do internships, there is actually no benefit because there's such a huge influx of people doing like BAs or BBAs and stuff like that, that an internship doesn't really give you a leg up because there's a recognition that the experience you're getting at an internship, at least in the American context, doesn't actually teach you anything, that it's a use for just a way to have free, like, unskilled labor within your workforce. So it's become such an aspect of pop culture that there's a group that's now like actively using it as a form of humor online kind of thing.
Mr. Lids, what do you got?
Well, I think to the extent that interns become normalized, I can agree with you, Cody, that how could you get a leg up if everyone is getting that experience through this process? It seems quite unfair.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I was interviewing Andrew Mead, I was trying to put myself in his head because a lot of what he was saying, he was discussing how you can draw very hard lines and say, okay, within this zone, it's okay to have unpaid internships as long as it's a student fulfilling some requirements required for their academic study as part of training. But as soon as they cross the line into that worker mode, then it's not okay. But I'm hearing all this and I'm thinking, well, geez, isn't it very easy for an employer just to try and stretch the meaning of what is a student and therefore take them out of the context of the worker? And as soon as they're a student and not a worker, then you don't have to pay them. And so I just thought of that. But then I'm thinking to myself, you know, he's in the media, and it's so prevalent, as he was describing in the media. It's just part of it. So that was interesting. And, yeah, I just, my mind was very critical because my gut reaction is there's something wrong with all unpaid internships, that if someone is doing something with an employer, it's really hard to say that they're not adding value in some way to that employer. And therefore, they should get paid.
Well, I think it draws back to when I was talking earlier about the changes to the federal model, where it's not tied directly to an academic institution, but it's more about the general idea of bettering the intern, so to speak. That really creates that vague line where, as you said, you can now shift somebody from being a worker to being, you know, an educational volunteer in kind of a weird way, right? Like you're volunteering your labor at that point. In lieu of paying for a course. So instead of paying to go to university to take a course, you're now volunteering your labor as almost a form of payment for an education, which, I mean, a lot of people think about that because, I mean, a lot of our economy, when you're looking at students, is now because employers don't do much of the training anymore. It's now put on the student to do a lot of the self-training. So it's about turning yourself into a commodity, so to speak. So it's like, how can I put as many things on me or in my resume to better myself in that way? So there, it's taking advantage of a very precarious generation in terms of trying to get into a labor force that knows it has an advantage over people.
Yeah. Got any final thought, Mike, before I...
Yeah, well, you know, if Canada's long-term interest really depends upon upskilling young Canadians, we can talk about this from a sector-specific approach, and maybe it's the case that some specific industries require very technical skills, and there is a cost to the firm in order to place those skills in the hands of young Canadians. But I think that's a question that we have to ask. What sectors are actually competing in global markets? What is the extent of competition that would really contribute to Canada's long-term interest if unpaid internships is something we're going to have a serious discussion about?
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see whether the efforts of the Communication Workers of America and the Canadian Association of Interns to at least put in more standards. And New Brunswick just has zero standards. So things like that, like there's still ground to improve on, even considering that they're not getting paid, which to me is a fundamental thing.
Which I found to be interesting that the MBSA, which is traditionally a more, I mean, I say conservative in terms of the small C conservative sense, is calling for interns to actually be on kind of like the whole be paid in general and just be treated as workers. So I think that's definitely a progressive approach for here in New Brunswick.
All right, so next up on the show, we're going to go to the interview with another Andrew, this time Andrew Nellis with the Street Laborers of Windsor. But before that, here's a little segue. Here's a tune by good pal Brian Rose, who has a song about the working class, in a sense. Here you go.
But can't afford to live in it. And I don't know if I'm proud to have this rich man on my back. People think you're strong when they see how far you can carry him. How far can you throw him? A friend said to me. My father looked at me and I felt guilty for even thinking of it. Sisters and brothers at the bottom, we can build all the ladders, but we'll never get to climb on. So shed the skin of servitude, my father. We can find another way just as long as we're together. Mom's at her second job and she's feeling pretty old. The rich man is buying, but don't sell him your soul. And I don't know if I'm proud to be in the working class. I'd rather be on welfare and you can all pay for my dinner. If you think that I'm a leech, then to me you're just a scab. We can't support each other if we still support the man. And I mean no disrespect to the good work that you do. That I could do half as good a job as you. But I'm just another bum trying to make it in this life. And you're just another worker selling all your fucking time. So shed the skin of servitude, my father. We can find another way just as long as we're together. Mom's had a second job, she's feeling pretty old. The rich man is buying, but don't sell his soul. Service class, 'cause I don't get paid enough to put up with all your bullshit, and I just can't find a reason to come down to work today. I don't feel much like smiling at you anyway. If you have a family, but it's hard to teach your children when you're stuck, depressed, and angry. And wouldn't it be nice if you didn't work more than you share? Own the means of production, and got the respect that you deserve.
All right, so going to put on the interview with Andrew Nellis now. So again, Andrew Nellis is an organizer of the Street Laborers of Windsor. So we're going to hear about the realities of organizing amongst panhandlers, buskers, and other street performers and workers.
Great tune, by the way.
My name is Andrew Nellis. I'm an organizer with the Street Laborers of Windsor, which is a shop of the industrial workers of the world. I was past spokesperson for the Ottawa Panhandlers Union in Ottawa, which was also a shop of the IWW. And I'm also the caretaker of our union hall, which is the Utah Phillips Center for the Hobo Arts in Windsor, Ontario.
Could you tell me a bit about the Ottawa Panhandlers Union? Is it still active right now?
As far as I know, the Panhandlers Union is still active. It's not as active as it has been in the past, but that's not unexpected. What we found is that when we organize on the street, things tend to come in cycles because our membership is completely transient. Sometimes the membership will dwindle down to just a small handful or even just one or two people and then slowly build back up again. This happens over and over again, which is one of the challenges of organizing on the street. I was repeatedly asked about this problem by the media, and I had to tell them that we knew it was going to be like this from the beginning, and we regarded it as a feature and not a bug. Because everybody in the union takes turns sharing all the workload, people learn skills that they wouldn't ordinarily have access to. For example, everybody takes turns at the meetings, being chair and taking notes as secretary, so that people learn how to hold a proper meeting. And these kinds of skills, they take to other cities with them as they travel.
Interesting thing about both the Ottawa Panhandlers Union as well as the Street Laborers of Windsor is that not dealing with traditional employers, but in a sense, empower the members. What do these unions empower their members against or for?
Well, when you say it's not traditional, not strictly true. It's not traditional in the sense that most people regard it, but the industrial workers of the world actually has a very long history of doing this kind of work. Back during the Great Depression, for example, it was common for the IWW to infiltrate work camps and organize the men to fight for better conditions. And in fact, there's stories about so many hobos being members of the IWW that if people tried to hop a train, the hobos would demand to see their union cards, and if they couldn't produce one, they'd pitch them right back off the train. So really what we're doing is carrying on a tradition in the IWW of organizing the unorganizable. The IWW has always been the sort of commandos of the labor movement, willing to go and organize where no other union would. The work that we organize is non-traditional in the sense that most people, most unions, would not consider them to be regular labor, but this is work that the IWW has been doing for over a century.
As far as work conditions, what issues, what kinds of issues would the Ottawa Pan Andrews Union, or did the Ottawa Pan Andrews Union and the street laborers in Windsor, what kind of issues come up as things that the members want to see changed, challenged, or done?
Well, each city certainly has its own particular challenges, but one of the things that I've noticed is the commonalities between them. For example, the loss of public space. Over the years, more and more space, which used to belong to the public, has been given over either completely or control over it given to business interests. So, for example, we've seen public bathrooms and water fountains and benches disappear, being replaced with commercial enterprises. So it's not uncommon to walk down the street in either Ottawa or Windsor and see signs in every window saying bathrooms are for customers only. We've also seen in Ottawa and Windsor where benches have been removed and replaced with patios where you have to buy a coffee or a donut in order to have somewhere to sit. And any of the concrete planters or places where people might be able to sit down, if people actually use them to sit, the BIAs or the city will put up steel barricades to keep people from actually using it to sit down. These kinds of issues have been growing for some time, and it's not just us either. I'm sure you're familiar with Jane's Walks, which occur every year in many cities around the world, which highlights this loss of public space. So we're fighting not just for our membership to regain control of public space, but for everybody else too. Windsor is a very poor city. People don't have money to be able to buy a coffee if they want to use the bathroom, and we don't think that they should have to.
Nellis talks about how a union can help resolve tensions amongst people on the streets.
Even on the street, you've got a kind of hierarchy. A lot of the buskers, for example, don't want to be associated with panhandlers, and the street vendors don't want to be associated with the buskers. And you've got this stratification going on. And one of the reasons we think it's useful to create a union is because it crosses those boundaries. It shows people where the commonalities in their struggles lay and how they can benefit by helping each other. It does no one any good when you've got, for example, hot dog vendors who are willing to collude with the city to prevent panhandlers or buskers from using those same streets. Everybody has a vested interest in keeping those streets free in the long run. Sometimes what you'll find is, and this, this is not unique to the streets. You find this in all kinds of industries where the bosses turn workers against each other. And you have to show people how it's in their own interest over the long term to build those networks, to build those links so that when they come after you, and they will, there are other people there who are willing to stand beside you, and that your voices together can have more power than any individual standing by themselves.
What about the actual allegation of threats that panhandlers and other street performers are somehow creating threats for the public?
Well, there's really no way for me to defend it. I mean, if a person doesn't want to see poor people, I can't make them want to see poor people. But the fact is, in this country, as it stands, until they manage to change the laws, The amount of money you have does not determine the number of rights you have. So if you want to drive poor people off the streets, you're going to have to do it over my dead body. By hook or by crook, I will make sure that we retain control over our streets. And the fact is, there are still laws that we can use to protect our interests on the streets. I really don't need to defend our existence on the streets because they're defended for us by the laws. And frankly, I really don't care if people feel threatened by the existence of someone with tattoos on the street. We saw that in Ottawa. We had a long battle over a pedestrian underpass, kitty corner from the Parliament Hill. When they put up fences under there, a member of our union was actually killed under that pedestrian underpass, and they used it as an excuse to put up barriers to prevent poor people from gathering there. We filed a $1 million lawsuit against the city when they did that. They argued that, well, we're doing it for their own good. And we had affidavits from social workers who said that, well, it's not ideal that people sheltered under that bridge. The fact is, they were using it as shelter, and they're safer under there than anywhere else. In the end, the city ended up settling with us out of court.
What are some other examples of control measures that you've confronted directly over your years?
Well, we had, in Ottawa, we had problems with a particular police officer. For people who may not be aware, every police department has a designated goon, a police officer, usually one with no neck, who abuses steroids, who's given free rein to do whatever it is that he wants. He's protected. So this is the officer that they assigned to harass or beat street kids, for example. In Ottawa, this officer had been doing this for a number of years. He would drag, he and his partner would drag street kids into parking lots at night, and they would beat the hell out of them. It was an open secret. Everybody knew that he was doing this, and nobody was prepared to report on it. Nobody was prepared to stop it. He was protected. He was a hero cop. He had got an award because he had dived into the river to save someone. So every time I gave an interview, I would name this cop, and of course the media would refuse to report on it. And eventually what we did was we got every street kid in the city and all of our allies together, and we locked down the street outside the police station, and we told the police, we are going to hold this intersection for 1 hour, and you are going to get rid of this cop. And if you don't get rid of this cop, we're going to come back, and we're going to do it again and again. And you're not going to stop us, and we're going to continue to do this, and we're going to be much less polite until you get rid of this cop. The next time, we told them that they had 1 month to do this, and we'd be back. And they didn't. I guess it's understandable. They didn't take us seriously. 1 month to the day, we tried to gather again, only this time they had riot cops ready. They had lineups of bicycle police standing between us and the youth shelter where most of our most of the street kids stayed, so that they would have to squeeze between police officers in order to reach the protest site. Some did, to their credit. They were willing to risk it. They had water cannons. They had police who walked back and forth through our gathering, trying to intimidate people or to provoke us into attacking them so that they'd have an excuse to arrest us. They had paddy wagons standing nearby so that they could scoop up everybody if they had to. I was told later by the police liaison that that was our official warning, that they pulled out all the stops to show us this display of force to warn us against what we were doing. But in the end, we decided to snake march, to lose as much of the police as we could. And once we had snake marched through downtown Ottawa, there were about between 30 and 50 of us remaining. We marched down to the police station, marched through the front doors, right past the police, occupied the lobby, all masked up with our flags and banners, and read our demands over a megaphone surrounded by a couple of hundred angry cops. And this time they did get rid of him. They promoted him to detective, and that's fine. You know, we understood that it's easier to promote them than to fire them, and he was protected. but we got the cop off the streets. Now, you know, by this time, I'm sure that there's a replacement cop. The battle is never ending, you know. So, I mean, that's a good example of the kind of things that you face when you're on the street.
What about these things in Fredericton? There are these parking meters, refurbished parking meters that they've installed. More
kindness meters.
Kindness meters. They call them the same thing there than they do here. Okay, exactly. So kindness meters were installed in Fredericton this past summer. There's a few of them downtown. And I know that they've been installed in a number of other cities. If I'm not mistaken, they tried to put them in Windsor, or they're thinking about putting them in Windsor?
They talked about putting them in Windsor and decided not to. Okay. They tried putting them in Ottawa. I think they installed one. It was quickly vandalized. It raised a total of about $50 in the entire length of time that it was there. And they didn't even do anything with that money. It just went into general funds.
Right. So what is your challenge to these kindness meters? Cities like...
I don't think they need to be challenged. They're an incredibly stupid idea. And any person who's kind enough to want to give money to a panhandler is not going to put them into a so-called kindness meter. And any person who would put money in a kindness meter is not someone who's going to give money to a panhandler anyway.
Nellis talks about the importance of not getting sucked into fighting on the terms of the city and other authorities through court battles and other formal mechanisms, but for organized street people to set their own terms.
It's important that you have programs there in place to constantly fight all of these formal mechanisms that are being used to scour the streets clean. A sort of a social cleansing program that they use to try and remove anyone who looks poor. But it's also vitally important that you have something that's working out of band. And by out of band, I mean you can't win when you fight them at their own game. It's a sucker's game, right? They set up the rules. They set up the structures. And while it's possible to beat them, In a particular fight, ultimately they'll win the war. They set up the rules. They're the ones who benefit from those rules ultimately. So it's important that you challenge them on their own turf, but it's also extremely important that you have things that you can do outside of that. You have to go out of band and fight them in ways that they haven't anticipated. And that's why it's very important to be creative in your actions. You have to use a combination of direct action and some very sophisticated media work, in addition to building networks with other organizations which are not necessarily directly connected to the street. So, for example, we would often build links with more traditional labor organizations, other unions, so that when we held a picket line, we knew that their members were not going to cross our picket, that they recognize us as a legitimate union.
We've already talked a bit about the IWW. You mentioned that both the Street Laborers of Windsor and the Ottawa Panhandlers Union are IWW unions. So can you just elaborate a little on what is it about the IWW, what about its character that separates it from other unions?
Well, as I said, it's been traditional for the IWW to organize in places that other unions will not. But on top of that, what the IWW does is it provides a structure. Originally, both the Ottawa Panhandlers Union and the Street Laborers of Windsor existed as informal entities for some time before they became IWW unions. I felt in both cases it was very important that they join the IWW because it provides a structure. And this is especially important when you're organizing on the street. People, when they're on the street, have chaotic lives. And I can't stress how important it is for an organizer to understand this. If a person is on the street and says, I'll meet you at such and such a time, the odds that they'll actually be there is probably about 1 in 10. If a person says, I absolutely, definitely guarantee 100% that I will be there, come hell or high water, the odds increase to about 1 in 3. And it's not that the person doesn't want to be there or that the person is irresponsible. It's that when you're on the street, your life is completely chaotic. You don't know if you're going to have money. You don't know when you're going to have money. You don't know where you'll be. You don't know if you'll have transportation. You don't know if you'll have someone to watch your things and watch your dog. You don't know whether you're going to be harassed by police on that particular day, whether you're going to be arrested, whether you're going to have to dodge the police, whether you can't be in a particular neighborhood because it's dangerous for you that particular day. All of these things come together to create this sheer chaos in your life that prevents you from being able to do anything effective. It wastes all of your energy. So the reason I felt it was important for these organizations to become formal members of the IWW is originally the Wobblies were created by and for blue-collar workers. These were people who didn't necessarily have very high literacy skills. These were people who were not politically sophisticated. And the union was therefore forced to create a lot of documentation and a lot of structure that's easily understood by people who were not accustomed to bureaucracy, people who were not accustomed to dealing with a lot of paperwork. So the IWW provides an important structure so that people feel that solidity. It provides record keeping and a regular system of checks and balances and reporting, but at the same time does it in a way which is not going to be confusing and is not going to be intimidating. So people whose lives are chaotic can then rely on the IWW itself to provide some of the supports which give them benefit in the rest of their life as well. Because if you want people to join an organization like this, especially people who don't have many resources to start with, you have to show that person how what you're asking them to join is of benefit to them. And that's, I mean, if you're familiar with Kropotkin's book, The Conquest of Bread, the basis of that book is that no sane person is going to join a revolution unless and until the revolutionaries can prove that they can feed everybody afterward. So it really is a sort of, a babies and butters issue where you need to prove to people that your organization can do practical, useful things for them before they're going to take any of their valuable time or resources to join your organization.
And, I mean, my own familiarity with the IWW and just how it goes into places that other unions don't. For example, also the Toronto Harm Reduction Workers Union.
Right.
And it automatically brings me to the point of, well, what is it about other unions where they don't go there? And then that brings me to, well, what is it about the labor law, formal labor law, which is restrictive? Is there anything you have to say about the labor law itself and ways that labor law, as it is now, is in some ways holding workers back, or even holding back who could even be considered a worker?
Well, yes. I have a very different definition of a union than most people do. I'm often asked by reporters, well, in what way are you a union? I mean, you can't go on strike. You don't sign a collective agreement. You don't do collective bargaining. How on earth are you a union? And of course, that comes because there's a misunderstanding of what a union is. All the original unions were illegal. Unions are simply a group of workers standing together for mutual aid and protection. Now, collective bargaining is something that a union can do, but that's not what a union is. And in fact, the IWW traditionally has not registered its unions with the government. The Starbucks Workers Union, for example, in New York, they haven't registered their union. They simply showed up at work one day wearing IWW pins and declared themselves to be a union. And this is why the IWW is so dangerous to corporate interests, is because they can't be shut down. We down, they can shut down other unions. If we don't exist as a formal entity, for example, how can they sue us? Normally, they'll shut down a strike by issuing back-to-work legislation. And if you defy the back-to-work legislation, they simply start fining the union money until it ceases to exist. Well, if your union doesn't exist as a formal entity, good luck finding it. And this I think, is the reason that the IWW can go places and do things that other unions can't. The model that the IWW uses is called solidarity unionism. There's one paid member for the entire union. All the other work is done on a voluntary basis. So you don't get that crust of bureaucracy that you find in other unions, these men in suits who come down and sit in a smoky back room with the bosses and work out an agreement that may or may not be in your best interest. In the IWW, we don't work with the bosses. So even if you have a collective agreement, your union dues do not go to the bosses, and then the bosses don't hand the money to the IWW. You pay your union dues directly to your delegate. And if your union ever stops representing you, if your union is not doing what you want it to do, you simply stop paying your union dues. This is what's kept the IWW from following down that same path that the business unions have. And this is why I think people who are on the street are willing to join a union like the IWW's, because they see that we're not like the other unions. We're not a bunch of guys in suits who want to sign a piece of paper. We understand how to fight. We understand how to get things done. And we understand that the important part of a union is that solidarity.
All right, so that was Andrew Nellis, Street Laborers of Windsor. And now to summarize everything you heard in the show so far today in its own form, we got MC Lids ready to rock.
Acting fidgety and laughing out uncomfortably. For penny poetry, you interrupt a shopping spree. Creative capital, I think you see the irony. Killed by kindness in a meter that you painted green. You wouldn't think that Lady Justice dealt with such deception, but after all, you smell the petrol and learn your lesson. For public freedoms, it's the median that gives the message, cause in the streets, the corporate interest heads its own direction. Condemn the vagrant, the people that live without taking for granted, the open-handed, slap at the border where government landed. You understand it? You never had to feel the damage, showing up a citizen and getting apprehended. I could sue and tort, you think that that will end it? I'm not even sure I'm supposed to live upon this planet. Life is for the meek, and I've been thinking I'm abandoned, labeled as unstable. Yeah, the city got me branded. Till I meet somebody who can speak a common language to tell me that nothing great can happen unless you plan it. It's no joke. Lady Justice gone blind. Send smoke signals in the skyline. We lose hope. It's time to fix the paradigm, cause it's broke and real people keep dying. It's no joke. Lady Justice gone blind. Send smoke signals in the skyline. We lose hope. It's time to fix the paradigm, cause it's broke and real people keep dying. Give me back my spirit, cause you paved it with this vacant black asphalt. Dragging my last haul, living it fast forward. Boys in blue will do whatever corporate tells them to, but you better believe when I'm on the scene that they're not gonna leave no apologies. Get back, you monsters. I told you the spirit belongs here. Collective solidarity, not a parking meter called charity. I'm aware of where this goes when we let money take control. And you thought Fredericton was cold. Now feel them chains around your throat. Those who really know the potential that can grow with the passion that you show, you can help to break the mold, the shackles that control baccalaureate souls. Back on my grind, whirling my mind, and look like freedom of the people. Yeah, does it measure up? Victorian society, the morality that they fed to us. I want vibrancy, not a quiet street. I believe in where I'm passionate. Streets ain't just for traveling. Those of us who call it home, it's something simple that we're asking dignity to live in a world where we can be forgiven, using all our strength to help out those who struggle with addiction. Only difference here, you judge them because they are misfits. If you only knew, then the commons, there's a common interest. Love all around when I move with the sound. I choose to be grounded, used to the pound of feet on concrete. Look like a zombie, everything you do can never really stop me. I'm a concept, I'm a word, I'm dialectic, what you heard. I'm a dead and absolute, I don't even need no proof. Now we're back and moving forward, making nonsense of your borders. Who's gonna bring this court to order? Who's gonna bring this court to order? Time drains that hourglass. Time to give it everything we have. Up against that money class, it's our streets, we want them back. Back to haunt me, my ghost. They found me in the East Coast. All I need is a bit of reprieve, and these cops leave me alone. Tell them y'all don't know him. Tell them y'all don't know him. When they ask about Lids and the things that he did, tell them y'all don't know him. You can't read them Elder Scrolls. A living history unfolds. Just leave your coin purses at home, cause all them values have been sold. It's no joke. Lady Justice gone blind. Send smoke. Signals in the skyline. We lose hope. It's time to fix the paradigm. Cause it's broke. And real people keep dying. It's no joke. Lady Justice gone blind. Send smoke. Signals in the skyline. We lose hope. It's time to fix the paradigm. Cause it's broke. And real people keep dying. Out the mainframe. Automated hive brain. Cava new geography. Samuel de Champlain. Started from the landscape. Fresher than the sixth Drake. Now you wanna partake after all the heartache? More, she's begging me born for legacy. You'll remember. Pour the Hennessy. You'll remember the shores of Freddy Beach. All the people that swarm vicinity. Stopping the problem that started the shop. It's free holding your family's closer than ever. Be more than a lonely Genevieve. The trigger warning. I'm on Jordan the Wobblies.
All right. From the margins.h-a-z.org. Got the Facebook to search for From the Margins. Fredericton, got the Twitter, Cody?
The Margins, CHSR.
All right.
And follow us on Facebook.
Right on. That's all.